Hello, I'm Mary Richards, and welcome once again to KHOI's Community Bookshelf, which can be heard every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evening at this time. Hello, this is Mary Richards. Welcome once again to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. We are reading The Horizontal World, a memoir by Deb Marquardt, who is professor of English at Iowa State University. The Horizontal World's subtitle is Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, and we last time had to leave right in the middle of a sentence that describes one of the incidents of what she considers her wildness, when her parents' car had burned because she had inadvertently lodged a lit cigarette in the backseat upholstery as she was on her way to her first job. I don't know why my mother granted me amnesty that morning, some act of kindness that I'll never be able to repay, but the secret weighed on me. I wanted to tell it as I watched my mother and father get the wiring repaired in the car, and as they made phone call after phone call to salvage yards, trying to find a blue front and back seat to replace the burned seats. They were only able to get a blue front seat. The back seat, the rest of the time we owned the car, was green, and the smell was awful. That sickly, sweet smell that always follows fire. It refused to be aired out of the car's upholstery. My father found a body shop in Bismarck that said they could eliminate the smell by filling the interior of the car for 3 days with a pink foam that was guaranteed to suck the fire smell from the car. The only problem was that the pink foam left a cotton candy smell in the car that was almost worse than the fire smell it had removed. I wanted to tell them as we drove to church each Sunday. I wanted to tell them, sitting on the green back seat. I wanted to tell them as the blue Chevy that smelled strongly like pink foam cotton candy rolled to Sunday Mass. I wanted to confess. But I never did tell them. And they never asked. Because in my family, we gave each other a wide berth. We did not inquire further. There are some stories in a family that are just too embarrassing for everyone to hear. A few months later, my father traded the car away and bought another blue car, this time a Ford. Hard to believe, over 30 years ago now, the night that I drove into the moraine to park with my first lover, a man much older than I, before he was my lover. I remember how we lay in the back seat of his 56 Chevy and panted for each other, two bodies that burned to be one unbroken skin. How to describe, so many years later, the ripeness of my body on that night, the soft white flame of want. So young and too soon, we go out into the world after nights like this, thinking it will always be this way, that our blood will always burn for someone, not understanding how desire collects hurts and gripes, cautions and misgivings, how it is tempered, numbed, and peeled away in degrees. After this, the initial loss, we wander through the world and look for signs of the familiar in the faces of those we meet. We get more outrageous and bold, more inventive and self-destructive in our search for it. We meet fellow travelers along the way, also in search of it. Of everyone we encounter, we ask, "Are you my lover? Are you my lover? Are you?" But it seems we have all forgotten the face of the beloved. He would be unrecognizable to us, even if we passed him on the street. That night in the moraine, with my first lover, who was not yet my first lover, as we lay panting for each other in the back seat of his 56 Chevy, I will stop his hands, move my mouth away from his hot mouth, and I will say something only a teenage virgin would say, something like, I thought you loved me even without sex, or I can't do this. And I will force him to slip on his pants, pull on his shirt. He will move into the front seat, disgusted, and quietly suck a cigarette down to a thin wedge of cinders, and I will join him, dressed now, my limbs shaky with the cold and with desire. Angry in his frustration, he will crank the ignition hard, his hands heavy with yearning, and something strange will happen. A part of his motor, something small and metallic and whirring, will zing up and shoot out of his engine, leaving two tiny punctures like hot bullet holes in the hood of his car. We will both get out of the car and run our amazed fingers over the still warm holes on the hood. We will turn around in the black night and feel our aloneness in that silent, watching place, until he agrees to walk the miles across the fields of the moraine to the nearest farmhouse, where my father will be waiting up. And although it will be a personal catastrophe for me, my father will have no choice but to fire up his high-powered tractor and remove the wreck of my not-yet-lover's car from our hallowed land. These are all things that happened. These are things that happened to me in that strange, ancient place. Chapter 6 On Lost and Crazy Sisters. My Grandma Geist had a crazy sister. Her name was Emma. She never married or had children, and she lived in California, a place that sounded wildly exotic to me as a kid growing up in North Dakota. Everyone in California, I assumed, had ocean views in their backyards and fruit trees growing in their front yards. When we were shoveling out of 6-foot snowdrifts at 20 degrees below zero, I imagined Emma in that California life, sitting on her sunny veranda in silk pajamas and bedroom slippers, with marabou frou-frous on top, eating hand-picked peaches, slathered in cream as she watched the ocean swirl and wisp. I use the term crazy because that's the term I heard growing up, either that or verrückt, a word the old folks used when they lapsed into German to keep important things from us. My friend, who knows the language, says that verrückt means spinning your finger at your temple crazy, which I don't recall anyone doing, only that they uttered the word with such emphasis when they spoke about Emma that it's one of the few words I retained out of all the streams of German I heard growing up. In my grandmother's photos from her early years, Emma is the thin, blonde one in the middle, with a stylish dress and shapely legs, looking as if she's about to make some fun for everyone. Her shy brunette sisters stand on either side of her, squinting at the camera through their wire-rimmed glasses. They look like wardens or safety officers in their flat shoes and cotton shifts. How Emma went from being the fun, crazy one, with wild ideas in her youth, to the paranoid, schizophrenic one who needed to be institutionalized in her old age, I don't know. I only recall that my grandmother received letters from her. I was too young to read, and she never offered to share their contents, but I often watched her read them at the dining room table. Sitting down with the latest stack of mail, my grandmother would study the swirls of her own name and address, scrawled on the front of the envelope in Emma's distinctive hand. Slowly she'd wind the stems of her wire glasses around the curve of her ears, then pick up the letter opener and slit the top of the envelope. "What does it say?" I'd ask after a few moments of silence. "Oh, nothing important," she'd answer, absent-mindedly, folding the letters' delicate sheets and slipping them back in the envelope. Questioning my mother years later about these letters, I discovered they were full of paranoid accusations. "They're trying to kill me. They're trying to get all my money." But who they were was never made clear to anyone in our family. What so tortured my grandmother, I think, was that her younger sister was growing older and more insane every day, and that she herself was too old, poor, and far away from California to help Emma. She'd remove her glasses and sit at the table, kneading the tired sockets of her eyes with her fingertips. The silence in my grandmother's house during those times was disturbing. The only sound was the ticking of the clock and the ever-staring eyes of relatives who watched quietly from photographs on the dining room buffet. In the center of that ocean of faces was a color portrait of Emma, professionally done with a smoky studio background and the photographer's signature embossed in gold on the bottom right-hand corner. It was an 8x10-inch glossy, 3 times larger than anyone else's photo, which meant that the wedding and school snapshots of distant and minor cousins attached themselves to it, tucked into the swirling edges of its thick gold frame. In the photo, Emma is caught in profile, her hair swept up in a French roll, her mouth slightly open, her head thrown back, as if the photographer has just captured her saying something extremely witty. She's wearing cat-eye glasses, absolutely cutting-edge fashion at the time, and a brocade dress that shows off her slim arms and bare shoulders. I remember the photo in such detail because I stared at it often, trying to reconcile the Emma in the photos with the Emma about whom the old people whispered, "Verrückt." These were the days I spent with my grandmother before I was old enough to go to school, and my mother had taken a job at a store in town to supplement our farm income. At first, my mother tried taking me to a babysitter, Mrs. Mueller, a German Hausfrau type who in my childhood imaginings bore an eerie resemblance to the wicked crone in all the grim European fairy tales. The woman with the crooked nose and the thin, stooped shoulders who wants to enslave and eat little children. But Mrs. Mueller was not mean. Mostly, I remember her ever-present apron and her incessant baking of bread, which caused a constant dusting of flour to be on her clothes, hands, and face. Mrs. Mueller's house was gray stucco on the inside and the outside, with a trampled brown lawn, an outhouse, and old rusting cars and broken-down sheds leaning in the backyard. The family clothing, the store that my mother had started working in, was situated on the last block of Main Street. Mrs. Mueller's house was 1 block off of Main. Even then, I was looking to better things. I was no more than 4, but I knew that my grandmother had just moved to town. Sometimes we went to her house for Sunday dinners. From my bearings, I suspected my grandmother's house was a block down from Mrs. Mueller's on Main Street, directly across from the park. I had a vague memory of the slides and swings. One day, after my mother dropped me off at Mrs. Mueller's, I went in search of my grandmother's white house with green awnings, her trimmed lawn, and her splashes of pink flowers. It took me 2 separate tries to find the house, sneaking out of Mrs. Mueller's each morning, trotting down the alley through the rows of garbage cans and the raspberry bushes, until I finally found my grandmother working in her garden. After that, my mother knew I was ruined for babysitters, and she never took me to Mrs. Mueller again. This is how I came to spend so many hours alone with my grandparents in that house that contained no kid things, only grandma and grandpa things, a root cellar, a sausage tub, and a wringer washer in the basement. Talcum powder, corn pads, and shoe stretchers in the bathroom. A grandfather clock that ticked and ticked through the silent afternoons. Packs of old letters with rubber bands run around them in the closet. And lots of photographs. Just as my grandmother's dining room buffet was a treasury of framed photos, so her house was a family matrix, the place where all the relatives eventually stopped when they visited our town. Her own mother had died young from an infection contracted during childbirth. She was buried somewhere near the family land, in a location that no one can easily recall. The sepia-toned portraits of my great-grandparents, Catherine and Frederick Hoffer, set in dark oval frames behind curved glass, watched over us from my grandmother's dining room wall. My great-grandmother came to this country, as all of my mother's family did, from Lutheran villages in the Klukstal region of New Russia, west of the Dniester River on the Black Sea. My great-grandfather, Frederick Hoffer, the man Catherine would marry, had immigrated to Dakota Territory in 1899 with his two brothers. After the Hoffer brothers left Russia, their father died, leaving their mother a widow. So in 1902, Frederick arranged for his elderly mother, my great-great-grandmother, to come to America and live out her last years among her children. But she arrived with a new husband, a widower named Doctor from the villages. This Mr. Doctor brought with him his young daughter named Catherine, the woman who would become Frederick's wife. Although I'd like to believe it was mad love or instant attraction, it's more likely that it was just convenience or family pressure that prompted Catherine to marry Frederick. Technically, her stepbrother, later that year, a fact that makes me especially sad when I read that she died in 1920 from complications after delivering her eighth child. In the only photo I have of my maternal great-grandmother, she's standing with a pail in her hand beside a tar paper shack, wearing a long dress cinched tight at the waist and at the neck. Standing on the steps to her right, in order of the tallest to the shortest, are three of her small daughters in immaculate white dresses. A black Labrador, who's been dead for at least 80 years, stands in the foreground with his tail pointed. What's stunning about the photo is Catherine's elegance, her upright posture and formal dress set against the squalor of the house. On the edges of the photograph behind the shack, the treeless horizon of North Dakota stretches forever. Catherine died a few years after the photo was taken, at 40, younger than I am as I write this, and I wonder if it is possible for me to find her, living as I do, in the next century, with no children and too much education, writing these words to her and all the other lost women in my family who lived early in the last century with nothing but more work, more children, and the unrelenting horizon to face down every day. My grandmother was only 13 at the time of Catherine's death. The two older sisters, Mary and Anna, who were around 15 and 16, quickly left home for marriages in other cities. This is a story that's repeated and repeated again if one asks questions about the early days in the territory, the family that fragments like an exploded star at the loss of the mother. The oldest children take over the fieldwork and the womanly chores, and the younger children are farmed out in ones and twos to various relatives. When they near adulthood, these children marry quickly, or join the military, spreading out into the world and rarely looking back to the site of the original painful disaster. Against this wave of destruction, My grandmother, only a teenager herself, imposed her will by pulling people to her. When she married at 16, she and my grandfather took over her father's land, which made them the keepers of the Hoffer home place. It's a strange thing about people whose families are tied to the history of homesteading. Even if we don't return to the Midwest to see our families, we still feel this tie to the original homestead. It looms in our imaginations no matter where we migrate to. We know the trees we watered as children and imagine them now to be 50 feet tall, never returning to discover they've withered and died or been chopped down long ago. We know the location of the barn, the chicken coop, the roads that lead out, and the fences that hem everything in. We could walk this territory in the dark, it appears so often in our dreams. And the couple that now lives on the land, even if they are not blood relatives, become a kind of original couple to us. The people who keep the candle burning in the window every night, we imagine, to light our long way home. In this way, my grandma and Grandpa Geist became the locus for my grandmother's floating, angry, dislocated siblings. All her life, she tracked their progress. When I was a child, it was enough for me to point to a photograph, and she would reel out the history of the person, who he or she married, where they lived, what their in-laws were like, how many children they had, diseases, divorces, career changes, accidents, lost limbs, military service, and any other upturns or downturns of fortune they may have endured. She had a tracking and cataloging instinct that drove her to keep a special photographic log of all the people she'd known who had died. In this album, she'd paste photos of the deceased in their caskets, horizontal with their hands crossed in that final bed of gathered satin, the pallor of death spread across their powdered skin and painted lips. Beside the photo, she'd tape the memorial card from the funeral, along with a copy of the obituary, or any other newspaper articles about them. She understood acutely the beginnings and endings of things, how closely they are connected, and she felt that fragility of life in every moment. She'd buried her two infant sons, both of whom died within their first year of life. So she held tight to my mother, her only living child. And when we were born, she held on to us, her grandchildren, with her large encircling arms. She had constant access to the full spectrum of emotion, the sparking wire of joy and its opposite, the bared and broken plunge into grief. I watched each day as she cauterized those two ends into a circle and inhabited the hot place where they were joined. When you went to visit her, even if you'd just seen her the day before, even if you were just stopping by on an errand, she'd greet you with tears in her eyes as if you'd been off on a long journey. She'd raise her warm, wrinkled hands to your face and pull you to her, your foreheads meeting, and in that moment you could feel that place inside the circle that she kept clear for you, and there was nothing you could ever do to change that basic, natural fact. Every family has a lost or crazy sister, someone who, whether by choice or accident, has become unmoored from the flow of the family. She's the woman, the slight mention of whose name is often followed by silence, the shaking of heads, the clicking of tongues. Her many changing addresses and the names of her many changing husbands are scarcely remembered and are recorded in light pencil strokes in the address books of the women in the family. Her children, after she's brought them screaming into the world, fly from her, spinning off like small satellites into the orbits of other families. If she remains childless, she is the name in the family genealogy from which no line descends, a dead end, a cul-de-sac in the ongoing roadmap of a family. If you've ever heard how they speak of her, you would never want to be her, the one who's vergessen, meaning either the one who forgets or the one who is forgotten. The one who, in forgetting her place inside the circle, is forgotten. If you keep going like this, my mother used to say to me, you're going to end up just like your Aunt Emma. This was usually yelled up the stairs in the direction of my bedroom, where I would be deep inside my closet, one arm in, one arm out of the 20th shirt I'd tried on that morning. For some reason, when I was a teenager, it was impossible for me to go anywhere without first trying on every single item of clothing in my closet. I'd pause, a turtleneck wringing my eyelids. In my mother's world, there was always an if, and there was always a then. Her statements were like geometric proofs clicking off in deeply inevitable ways. But listen to her cadences, just like your Aunt Emma. 5 hard stresses followed by 1 unstressed syllable, the let up, the way out, if I am to heed her cautions. And listen to my mother's erasures. Your Aunt Emma, not my Aunt Emma. As if through language she could rearrange the generations and unlink herself from the chain. There is fear in the whispered inquiries about the lost and crazy one, as if merely speaking her name will activate some dormant code and draw her to you through locked doors, down from attics, unlocking genetic formulas, striking you wild in the head. Wildness, vanity, being too high-strung or too full of yourself, these are signs that you are a child on course to becoming an extravagant adult. So you must be monitored at all times, admonished and harnessed by turns, and generally tempered. Every trip my mother and I made to Bismarck to buy school clothes ended in a scream fest, her, and a crying jag, me, as we tried to reach a compromise about what she would buy me to wear for school that year. There was an alarming gulf, it seemed to me, between my aristocratic good taste and her peasant leanings. I dreaded going into those clothing stores in the mall, full of track lighting and flattering skinny mirrors, because I knew I would want the blouse made of natural fibers with the nice label and the big price tag, and she would always find something easy to wash in a sensible color on a sale rack. She would pull my treasured object from the hanger and turn it inside out to examine its seams. In her immigrant-born, depression-bred way, she knew how to uncover the blouse's structural secrets to ascertain what kind of trouble it would cause us down the road. I never considered the limitations of her resources. All the clothes she had to buy not only for herself and my father, but also for my 3 older sisters and my brother. All I understood was my own want, surely an earmark of the lost and crazy one. Deep on the top shelf of her closet, stashed behind her purses and shoe boxes, she kept coffee cans full of silver dollars she'd collected over the years from her part-time job in town. And this is where we must leave today our reading of The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, written by Deborah Marquardt, coordinator of the Creative Writing Program at Iowa State University, and published by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group, New York, in 2006. I'm Mary Richards, producer of this program. I would like to thank Janet Kloss, assistant producer, the program engineer Ron Latson, and the chief engineer Rick Morrison. You've been listening to KHOI's Community Bookshelf, which you can hear every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evening at this time. For prior episodes, check the bookshelf page at the KHOI website. Thank you very much for listening. You have been listening to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. This is Mary Richards. Thanks very much for listening.